Well, I want to thank Amy for inviting me to take part in this project. It's been a wonderful experience, and some of you I've known and spent some great long time and good time getting to know you all better, and I made some new friends with me, so for that I'm very grateful. And then also for Patrick. He was very, very instrumental in helping me get launched onto this program. When I began writing this, I was in the midst of revisions for my book, which is on suicide and suffering in the Civil War era South. And I wanted to stay tethered to something I was working on so I didn't get too far afield in terms of my thought processes. And so I asked Patrick, do you remember seeing anything about like PTSD or war trauma, generally speaking, the psychological effects of the war coming through, and he said, oh yeah, we have a couple of things, and so that's where I went immediately. In particular, and this is dealt with in my book, although I don't resolve it to my satisfaction, and I do want to move into this area subsequently, and that is trying to get a better understanding of the connections, or rather the lack of connections, that the Civil War era people made between military experience, traumatic military experience, and aboriginal behavior. Southerners, in my book, seem to go out of their way to avoid making those connections, especially when it pertains to soldiers. So for example, I look at asylum records, because that's where suicidal patients oftentimes end up. And I might find a veteran who is there. And by the way, they don't say, oh, he was a soldier. So you then also have to like try to track them through the military service records. But it's also indicative of them not really making that connection. It meant nothing to them in terms of identifying the cause of their particular malady. And so you would have these soldiers who end up in asylums and, you know, have severe mental illness, mania, violence, suicidal tendencies. And what did the caregivers and family hit on as the cause? Masturbation, intemperance. They might have been hit in the head. That makes sense to them. Exposure, sunstroke, but never soldiering. Never the experience of being a soldier. Now, the literature tells us, of course, that this is pre-Freudian world, and so they have not yet made the distinction between the brain as an organ and the mind, the psyche. So it makes sense then for them to try to figure out what physical or somatic causes are at play when somebody is exhibiting what we would call mental illness. They're looking for physical triggers, not experiential triggers. So what I want to do is to figure out in the Civil War when, if ever, the principals begin to make those connections. There are a few exceptions, and so what my working theory is that there are breaches in this thought, and what we may be seeing is a transformation in this medical knowledge. One of them is civilians. There are more people who end up in asylums in South Carolina and Georgia because of William T. Sherman, who's blamed for them losing their minds. Loss of property, right? Also, when people end up financially ruined, they call it pecuniary difficulty. So they're embarrassed, pecuniary embarrassment. Loss of a loved one or multiple loved ones during the war. In terms of soldiering, there's only one experience that I have been able to document that made sense to families and caregivers as far as a cause of mental illness, and that's the POW experience. And in my book, I argue that I think that has a lot to do with the fact that these men they've lost the ability to control their destinies themselves, their reactions, and there's so much information proliferating after the war about how horrific these places are, so people get that, they can understand that. And one of the cases I'm going to talk about is, in fact, about a POW. So my question is, were there incidents when people during the Civil War actually considered experiences as a cause of mental illness? Was the Civil War important in advancing the notion that traumatic experiences cause mental illness. Or to paraphrase Howard Dean, what did Southerners know and when did they know it? So, I'm sorry, what did I say?
Howard Green.
What did I say?
Howard Dean,
yes, good. Yes, not John Dean, Howard Dean, thank you. Fellow Tennessee. So, I went to petitions looking for appeals for Picard, and I found a number of cases where there were soldiers and also a couple of civilians who were convicted of a crime, anything from gambling to murder. And they wanted their appeal, they heard, or they had people on behalf of them make that appeal. And they used the experience of the Civil War to explain their aberrational behavior, and as obviously this was an excuse to get their case heard before the governor, and then hopefully dismissed and pardoned. One of the things that I also note about this is that through these processes, we're seeing a great deal of compassion and empathy exhibited for soldiers and civilians who were in these experiences, including those who become drunks, which is a little bit different than we know about the 19th century, and that we're seeing some loosely formed ideas about the connection between deviant behavior and the context of the Civil War. And so that's what I want to talk about in my remaining time. And I'll talk about two cases, one of which is a very brief case, the other one which is a little bit more complicated. And the first one is about John Crittenden, who was 44 when he enlisted in 1863. He was a father of 8 children. His wife died right before the war, and he remarried, so he started a new young family during the war. He was a good citizen. He was honest and industrious. During the late rebellion, he was unshakably loyal, and he had exhibited good behavior until he committed a murder in Williamstown, Kentucky. Now, several aspects of this murder struck the 70 petitioners as odd. He was, before the war, peaceful and unoffending. He also didn't know his victim. He had never had any dealings with the victim. He had never been known to engage in a quarrel. He wasn't somebody who was known to engage in a fracas. Interestingly, he had no memory or recollection of the murder after the event. And this led the petitioners to characterize him as suffering from mental alienation brought on by ardent spirits. So mental alienation, a mental illness in 19th century language, but that it was brought on by alcoholism, that was brought on by the war. Now, what was the actual cause of his distress? While he was away at war with his 3 or 4 sons in the 30th Kentucky Infantry Company B, he was receiving letters from his new wife, and she was complaining about how the family was suffering. She didn't have enough money to survive. He hadn't been paid in months and months, and so he was unable to send her money. And the landlord was evicting the young family. In fact, this is the example that I referenced yesterday for Anne. The landlord had seized the family's only milking cow for rent, and of course they had all these young children. And so this set of circumstances led Crittenden to seek solace in a bottle. So that explains why he was unstable and had committed this crime. Now, the other story I'm going to tell is a little bit more complicated. It involves a man by the name of Robert Buffum, and some of you are familiar with him because you worked on that case study yesterday for your teaching unit. He was convicted in May of 1864 in Louisville for basically armed robbery. He and 2 Army compatriots went into a boot store owned by a German resident and his wife, and left with boots without paying for them. And he was convicted, obviously, but he was supposed to be drunk at the time, and that was one of the mitigating circumstances. There's appeals letters from his wife, of course, would want him released, but also there was a letter from somebody representing Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, who pleaded for commutation. The justification was Buffum's impressive war record. Seems he volunteered for a very dangerous mission along with a group of civilians, spies, and some other soldiers. They launched a very, very elaborate attempt to try to hijack a railroad engine near Atlanta, bring it back to Tennessee, and along the way, tearing up railroad ties and telegraph lines, with the idea being that they would prevent the Confederates from sending up troops and supplies as they tried to take Chattanooga. As you might expect, this is time-consuming work, so lo and behold, they are eventually captured by Confederates. The leader, and I think about six of the saboteurs, are executed. Some of them end up escaping, but Buffum and maybe eight others end up being imprisoned for about a year, during which time they were moved around from camp to camp and apparently kept under really horrific conditions. Eventually they were exchanged for other prisoners, they were brought back. Stanton awarded Buffum a Medal of Honor in March of 1863, and this becomes known as the Great Railroad Chase, and in the 19th century it's very well known. There's a big tome that's written about it. Okay, so he's heralded as a hero, and this is leveraged to try to get him off of his convicted charge of theft, basically. But what's more interesting to me are the reasons that are embedded in these petitions. It was not merely the duty to go above and beyond, but rather his, quote, extreme peril and prolonged suffering that required the pardon by the governor. Buffum's wife and others describe vague references of, quote, unquote, suffering that he experienced while in prison, and they believe that those constituted mitigating circumstances. And I believe this is more than just a ploy, because there's subsequent evidence that he really was suffering psychologically as a result of this. He was released, he resigned, he was released from service because his health was very, very poor. His wife filed a petition in 1866 for pension relief, and she said, the reason is my husband is suffering because he spent time in Libby prison. Quote, the horrors and sufferings endured so affected him that he is now a confirmed maniac. The following year, he filed for a pension claim, and he also at that time attributed his captivity experience to his physical and mental debility. Quote, the long imprisonment, exposure, and cruelty with which we were treated while in the hands of the enemy has so impaired my health and mind that I am in no condition to earn a livelihood for myself. He eventually ends up in an asylum in Massachusetts where medical records suggest that he is, quote, a homicidal maniac, and they too make the connection to his experience of war. They blamed, quote, intemperance and the experiences from being in the army. Against the advice of the officials in the Massachusetts asylum, he self-releases. Instead of going home to his wife, from whom he is separated, he goes to the family home of one Joseph C. Burns in Newburgh, New York. And they show up at his parents' house. And apparently they're causing trouble, going out and drinking. And so the father, 60-something-year-old father, says, look, to Buffum, here's some money, get out of here. Well, Buffum is insulted, he becomes angry, and he takes that money, he buys a pistol, he comes back, and he shoots Mr. Seaburns while he's at the dinner table, cold-blooded murder. The trial that follows also has tremendous documentation on what people think about his condition and the cause, not the least of which is Buffum's own assessment. Mood instability, volatility. While in jail, Buffum attempted suicide by standing on the top of his cot and then diving headfirst into the floor seven times. When he spoke about his condition, he explicitly made the connection between his aberrational behavior and his experience. Quote, this great and terrible war has fetched me where I now stand. He talked about being locked in underground dungeons and having to be in an iron cage. He was chained by the neck and handcuffed. He was held at eight different prisons. To Buffum's mind, his suffering rendered him innocent. Innocent of the charge, quote, as the child unborn, for I knew not what I did. He concluded, By my service to my country, I have been made a pauper, a lunatic, a criminal, and he pleaded for mercy. He got mercy. He was sentenced to life at Sing Sing. He arrived there within a week. He was shipped off to the insane asylum in Auburn, New York, and he committed suicide within 2 months. So, what does all of this mean? I hope you'll tell me. But I have a suspicion that my working theory has some credence based on these cases, that this was a time of fluidity about ideas about the cause of mental illness linking to the experiences that were very traumatic. Sometimes they're indirect, sometimes they are tentative, but they're there. So I see this period as a time when the conventional thinking about aberration behavior is beginning to crack a little bit. And so that's Blaming the Civil War, and that's the title of the paper, is really about figuring out that there is a connection between wartime experience